Is that it?
That was it. We started. I always like to ease
and he's
in.
Good. He's
it's sort of like
real good.
It's sort of like my dates in high school. You know.
Did you say that?
Well,
your date started off by you saying,
"I'm just going to ease it in." That's usually
I'm real good. And then you, yeah, and then
she's waking up from the real hip doll. That's usually
whoa,
when I
hey,
say that.
Wait a minute. I have an image to uphold. Please.
What, I'm just saying it was...
Don't even try to paint me as a misogynist.
I didn't say that that was you who
I
did that.
I am so pro-woman, it's not even funny.
You're so pro-woman?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm so pro-woman, I have all the pictures
I highly endorse. I highly endorse the female species, gender, yeah. Sex, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. Why do you walk me
into... I have
the
picture of
why?
The meme. I love all the women.
Well, you know, some people think that when you program an event that has... film sometimes in which women are roughed up that you're anti-woman, you know, I don't know. Yeah, what
when you're making movies, when you're showing movies with 9-minute ass rape scenes.
That was movie.
Okay.
Movie. With, yeah.
Okay.
As far as I know, that's the only time in marathon history we've shown a film that had that graphic and prolonged of a sexual assault. And let's
wait, shall I recall what about the Serbian film? I don't know. They didn't go for an entire reel.
Prolonged, I think, is the key term there. There was graphic sexual assault in Serbian film, but prolonged, not that prolonged.
There was a lot of it.
There was the
pervasive.
Guy, what, crippling, killing the girl from behind by beating her spine.
Newborn yeah. Porn.
Yeah, but that was that had a purpose behind it. That was not a titillating film.
There was the family affair. There's all the good stuff in the
family
Serbian
affair.
Film.
There you go. Yeah, that's all I thought was Sly and the Family Stone soundtracking that scene.
I've been watching. I've been watching the old episodes of Bonanza. Which
well,
I have
good.
To say that I have to say that Michael Landon would not have approved of any of the events.
Probably not. No.
In pretty much any marathon that's ever happened.
How are you going to make me think if I ever watch Serbian film again? Which no, for those of you out there in Radio Land, I don't have Serbian film on auto repeat 24/7.
He plays it to go to sleep.
Yeah.
The screams.
If I ever watch that again, now I'm going to be thinking of that scene at the end where. The guy's brother, or it's the reveal is it's him.
Oh, see,
I'm just going to think
go.
Of him.
Spoiler
think of,
alert!
I'm just going to think of him turning to Milos, going, "It's a family affair." That would be awesome. But okay, to put the blame where it belongs, Irreversible, the film we're referring to.
I know it's Stuart Gordon.
Stuart Gordon's choice. Now, I do applaud him.
Okay, there's a lot of reasons to applaud
yeah.
Stuart Gordon.
Yeah, and I when he made that suggestion, I think I answered back and said, "You're a sick man. I admire that."
He came to the marathon when it looked like it was a Gaza nightclub.
He did. He liked it too.
He did.
So the secret
like,
message
this is perfect for Irreversible.
The secret message is probably Stuart Gordon, Zionist thug.
That's exactly what it is.
It took us all these years to figure it out, wow. But that's how it is. Yeah.
All right. Thank you and good night. We are done now.
Hey!
Final episode of Marathon Chat.
I'll be signing outside.
This is not the final episode. This is.
We have not been canceled yet.
This is the penultimate episode before we have the 666.
The grand explosion of terror. The 666th.
Continue, please.
Ohio.
Line.
24-hour horror. Marathon.
Yes. And then what happens
not
after
to be
that?
Confused with Rockpocalypse. What did I say
that.
About Rockpocalypse? How did I describe it? Oh, a night in rock and roll hell. Not to be confused with that. This will be another night in hell, but this will be a more varied night
a more
in
traditional
hell.
Night in hell.
More traditional more night traditional. In hell. Those of you who are hell traditionalists.
We will not be doing the Freddy.
No.
Although I liked Cuckoo Patrol. Did I say that in the last episode? I think so. I think I
think well
heralded the joys of Cuckoo
Patrol. We've delayed this podcast
because oh, that's right. We haven't
yeah
had one
we
in
didn't
August.
Do one in August. No,
I liked Cuckoo Patrol.
It was slightly better than I thought it would. For yeah. the, by the way, if you've never heard this before, this podcast before,
you're probably not listening by now.
You're probably thinking, oh boy, another couple white dudes just yapping for a while. No, we ran an event back in August called Rockpocalypse, and it was four bad rock music-related films, plus a bunch of trailers and other things. And the movie Kevin's referring to, Cuckoo Patrol, starred Freddie and the Dreamers, who were a kind of a one-hit wonder back in yon 60s era. Cuckoo Patrol was...
Well, two. They had two, because they had the two to Freddie.
Yeah.
And then they had, I'm telling you now. That,
okay, two-hit wonder. I think you could...
That's how you can get a movie.
You could combine both of them together into a one-hit deal.
Sure.
Yeah. Cuckoo Patrol was mildly entertaining, I'll give it that.
I like Cuckoo.
I tell you what, The Day the Music Died, not as awful as I thought it would be.
Was that the one that I watched?
That was the Murray the K.
What was the other one?
Reenactment where he appears in the radio station going, this is Murray the K with breaking news about
I think I finally just gave up.
Oh, you missed out on that? Where the man, they're fighting against the man, and the grand irony is the man is played by a black guy in a suit.
Riding
around in his limousine.
I saw that part, but halfway through I broke up with that movie and I left.
It wasn't.
When I talked to Kevin at this concession stand.
Bruce pitched that to me as being sheer awfulness, and it really in total.
He's very accurate,
it's not that bad.
Oh yeah.
Well, and two, the pitch for the movie is there was almost no
story.
Music footage. Well, story, please. Why were you looking for a plot? The pitch for the movie was there was almost no usable footage left at the festival, but there actually is a decent amount of performance footage. It's not like 5 seconds here, 5 seconds there.
Yeah.
So. That was okay. Can't Stop the Music, though. That killed my soul.
That finally got to me.
The
print was also warped. That was
warped.
It was warped.
Warped?
Warped by Will Wheaton. No, it was warped because like half was in focus and half wasn't.
That
happens sometimes with 70s disco movies that have been sitting in a vault for a while.
It was probably a case, too, of not doing a ton of prep before the marathon. Because believe it or not, for Rockpocalypse, we didn't test run the whole thing beforehand. Sorry. Maybe that was disappointing. And incident at Channel Q, I had to leave partway through because I was getting really tired.
Yeah.
And I had seen the videos before.
We made it through all of them. Like I said, I walked out during the day
the music died.
That day the music pretty much killed me.
You didn't? You had no more taste for Murray the K?
Yeah. No, I mean, it started great with Cuckoo Patrol. It was fun.
The trailers were well worth it. Although, if I never see another trailer for a twist movie again,
the trailers. I thought the event was fun. I will say, on the one critique I would have is, the trailers got a little repetitious.
I didn't program any of the trailers, so you're blaming the wrong person.
I'm not blaming. I'm just offering.
If you'd like to blame the right person, here the address is Bruce Bartu. What? No, I probably shouldn't give that. Yeah.
No. What, you're going to give us home address?
Yeah.
Yeah, do that. Why not? No one listens.
He's the only Bartu in the phone book in Columbus, I think.
Okay. Thank you for adding that.
That's how I first spoke with him outside of the marathon back in 1994. He's going to kill me for revealing all this stuff now.
That's okay.
That this is true. But I looked up his phone number in the white pages, and he was one of two Bartus. And he was clearly listed as Bruce Bartu.
It wasn't listed as Bar2D2?
No. He's still working on that. Yeah, I think part of his intent with the trailers, especially with the twist collection, was to see if he could kill the audience. He didn't quite do it, but it wasn't all curatorial intent.
Yeah. That's okay. I mean, it was a fun event.
Yeah.
It was a fun event.
I think, too, if we had maybe played up the trailers more, we could have drawn a few more people.
Yeah.
Because we really played up the movies and trailers, where I think we should have played up tons of phenomenal, it's like a trailer-thon that happens to have some features in it.
Yeah.
It would have helped, too, to have better features, but that's
another deal
altogether.
It was, if I were to give any sort of, analysis, this isn't even a criticism, but just analysis, it was basically the bad version of showing Hard Day's Night, Woodstock, and then you could still have had Can't Stop the Music. And then if you had ended with
the Apple
Airheads or something like that, as something similar theme wise that people would recognize. But these are so obscure.
It was like the evil twin of that marathon that could have been.
But you would have never, showing a Hard Day's Night, you would have lost your entire budget then, probably on that.
Possibly, yeah.
Again,
I tread a fine line because this was Bruce's idea, and that's not to blame him, but it was more of something he had wanted to do, and I aided and abetted, but I was not the prime mover, so I don't want to.
I'm not. I don't want to.
I don't want to defend or or rag on it too much.
It was a fun event, I will say. It was a fun, interesting event, and I saw things that I had never seen before.
I did too.
Anyway, speaking of
including
things
that, your son with a mustache laying down on a bench in the back.
My son Ben for some reason the night before he had gotten out of like one of those vending machines at like Skyline Chili, one of those sticky mustaches.
They have vending machines at Skyline Chili?
Yes.
Whoa.
Well, they're like not cigarettes.
I know where I'm going after this show.
There you go. Well, they have like stickers and stuff like that. I think that's where he got it. Or he got it at the dollar store, which is right down the road, down the strip from Skyline Chili, and it was a little mustache that he put on, and he was going to this thing with the, like you had taken Burt Reynolds and washed him in hot water.
Yeah.
And then put him in the dryer.
That's what I thought too.
Yeah. It was kind of amazing.
It was fun. And how old is he?
He's 11.
11, yeah. 11-year-old with a fake mustache laying on the bench in the back of the theater.
like a homeless person.
It was great.
Oh, it was so funny because I made him watch. It was for an incident in Channel Q, and we got up, and I said, are you going to watch this, or are you going to go lay in the back like a homeless person? He goes, I'm going to go lay in the back like a homeless person.
Good move. Smart move.
Oh, that kid.
Yeah. So anyway, now that we've firmly established that Rockpocalypse happened.
Yes.
And that I am pro-woman in every possible way.
Okay. I love the women.
Let's talk about some of these anti-women films we got at the
Yeah,
Madonna.
Let's
talk about Dario Argento now that I've established that I'm pro-women. It was Argento that is always endlessly quoted. He has like four or five pull quotes to offer for this where he will defend how he enjoys seeing women killed on film.
Mm.
And if it
makes me hot in the pants.
It's one of those where... It
gives me the...
If he had only said
what,
that.
What do they call it in Cabin in the Woods? It gives me the husband bulge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. God. I forgot about that.
The husband bulge.
Dario Argento in defending... Because if you've never seen a Dario Argento film, women are often in trouble in his films and are often killed in graphic ways. There are guys who are killed in graphic ways in his films, too. But
the fashions. Hey.
Yeah, yeah. He has always defended it. He says something like, you know, killing is a, or like killing on film is a very stylish thing and it's much more enjoyable. And again, this is where people kind
then
of don't
dinner,
get it.
Well,
there's
talk.
That. Yeah. He says it's more enjoyable to see beautiful woman. I'd rather see a beautiful woman getting killed on film than a man getting killed. And it makes sense in a lot of ways because if you think about it, especially back when he was making most of his films, 70s, 80s.
Oh, no, he made Dracula last year.
Well, most. Let me rephrase that. Most of his worthwhile.
Women die in Dracula.
Most of his worthwhile films. No offense, Dario, wherever you are. When he's at the peak of his career, we're really still in a cultural mindset where, you know, women are accepted as being, you know, often physically weaker than men. Yeah. And there's that primal aspect of a lot of times if a man is chasing a woman and you're seeing it, you will, out of empathy, I think, oftentimes think, oh, shit. And a lot of times in those films, the man or the killer or whoever is physically way more imposing than any of the victims.
Yeah.
And when you have that kind of hardwired into your mindset, this will be interesting in like 10, 20 years to see if we still have these same reactions. But when you have that hardwired into your cultural mindset and that lizard brain thinking of hulking man threatening woman, less physically hulking, in trouble. Oh, God. That's where so much of that thrill comes from. I think he was trying to get to that. It wasn't like, I love women being assaulted. It was.
Well, and it's funny because you're coming at it. That quote comes at it from a very sexist view anyways, because it's completely talking about the male psyche. The reason women in horror films getting attacked is because the man worries because he wants to protect the woman.
Yes.
And the women empathize with being in that situation. Whereas if a man's being chased by a hulky man, there's probably a more traditional response for the man to turn around and fight.
Very true.
So
yeah.
And I think it affects men and women differently.
And when he's making those films, I have nothing to back this up. So obviously I'll sound like a boob when I say this.
That's okay. I love boobs. Just as much as you love women.
Thank you.
I love boobs.
When he's making those films, for the history of horror films, most of your target audience probably is a male audience.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, you know, think of all the classic horror films that are built off the male gaze and the viewpoint of the male psyche. Halloween brilliantly plays off of that, mm-hmm. in that you have one of the strongest female figures in horror at that time, in Laurie Strode. But part of the thrill of that film, part of the strange push and pull of it, is seeing through Michael Myers' perspective at various parts, or having that, mm-hmm. the pure identification with the killer.
Well, and you know, not to you know, get ahead of ourselves, but Texas Chainsaw is very much like that.
Texas Chainsaw, yeah. Marilyn Burns, rest in peace. Yeah. One of the great resilient heroines in horror history, and she gets put through the ringer. But you really, and you do. I mean, that's a case too, I think, where I don't know. That's a tough one to think. If say Franklin, well, Franklin's in a wheelchair. If the guy, her, the
have a good time, Franklin.
Paul, not Paul Partain. The guy who's the good looking dude.
Yeah.
If he is the guy who's at the center of the story the whole time, will you have the same reaction of him going through what Marilyn Burns goes to?
No, you wouldn't.
No, yeah, it would be...
Because there's also a certain amount of... There's a primal reaction you get when you've literally got a woman tied to a chair and there are three insane people staring at her.
Yes.
And they're all guys.
And
which is busted.
Including one guy who's dressed androgynously at that point, yeah. as in a wig and as the mother figure of the whole family.
Yeah.
Now, what's really interesting...
Although, I think, honestly, that the androgyny of Leatherface in the original is... It's such a grotesque thing,
yes.
that it's like one of the last things you'll consider.
Yeah.
Whereas in the sequel, it's much more clear that they're putting him in a dress.
Oh, yeah.
Because Leatherface makes an ugly man or an ugly woman. It doesn't matter. It's just he's a monster.
Yeah.
So yeah. They kind of give him the Mrs. Doubtfire look in the sequel.
Now, what's interesting is you look at Your Next, which we're also showing. Mm. There's a case where you have three physically intimidating, hulking guys stalking the family. And the heroine in that obviously fights back.
The heroine from Step Up 3.
But that's right. Wow, boy. From Your Next to Step Up 3.
Did she do... No, she did Step Up 3 first.
Did she do... wait.
Well, how long was Your Next
can? What was the...
most recent one was Step Up All In. Was
I'm sorry. See, this is what happens when I don't
That's
have
Brianna
to...
That's Brianna Evigan was in that one. She's Bill Evigan's daughter.
This is what happens because I don't have to review shitty... I mean...
various
movies for a career.
Here's an interesting thing, and it goes to something you posted on Facebook recently. You were complaining about aspect ratios at cinemas.
Oh, I don't know if you want to open that can of worms.
Should I?
That could hurt so many people and me. there's a major.
Let's just say that
there's a major theater corporation that will rain down hellfire upon my weakening head if we get into that. Well, what do you want to say?
All I was going to say is, I went and saw Step Up All In for review, not because I wanted to.
Yeah.
And I was the creepy guy because it was all like moms and their daughters who are in a dance. And
then
this lowly bastard coming in. And I wasn't wearing pants. That was a mistake. I think from the beginning I should have known.
It was anyways, hot. I don't know. You know.
But anyways, I'll just say this diplomatically. I saw it at a theater that was purported on your post to be a theater that does not do, that does project and put up the matting. It didn't put up the matting.
Hmm.
So just to throw it out there.
That's too bad.
Yeah. And it was like the day after I saw you.
That's
comment.
Too bad.
But for those who don't know, just the whole thing is that a lot of movie theaters aren't bothering to change the matting of the film based on the aspect ratio. And so you get the black bar at the top and the bottom because of the screen. And even though it's projected as black, it looks like your TV sets.
Yeah.
Basically.
Boy, you know, it would be a great end to my life if said major corporation sued me for like libel or slander just off of mentioning them. And that would be...
It wasn't the place that you originally mentioned. It was what somebody else...
Oh.
What somebody else said doesn't do that. And
wait, was this a multi-screen? Well, they're all multi-screens.
Yes.
Was this Oh. Wow.
Yeah. Just to let you know.
Oh, God. It's
everybody's
spreading.
Doing it. Nobody's putting up the
matting
kids, anymore.
Some of you out there listening to this, you're like 10. You like going to the movies, and you are the consumers of the future. You're the ones who will have the money, the billions and billions of dollars to spend on your disposable income and your entertainment option. When you go to a theater, 10-year-olds. Demand they have the proper masking, please.
They won't.
It's a small thing. It really is.
They won't.
Well, we'll have to do a podcast about that at some point. Hey, I know our audience.
Stories I can tell.
I know what kids listen to this podcast. They're trapped in their rooms, locked in there at night by awful parents, and they need something, so they have us.
Let's get on like full track here.
Okay.
Quickly, real quickly, just to remind everybody, the movies that had already been announced, Nosferatu, the Werner Herzog version of it.
Just for a reset, we are, of course, talking about the 666th annual Ohio 24-hour horror marathon, a.k.a. Shock Around the Clock. That's October 18th and 19th at the Drexel Theater in beautiful downtown Bexley.
Eek.
Noon to noon, nonstop terror, entire rotation of the planet with all of us.
Yes.
I can't wait.
The movies that have already been announced are, well, everything's been announced, but most that have been, we've known for months, were Nosferatu, the 1979 Werner Herzog version, the original The Invisible Man with Claude Rains from 1933, The Wicker Man, the original 1973, not the bees version.
Nicolas Cage not included.
The Nicolas Cage riding a bike while he's mad. There's The Shining.
That's a great way to sum up that film. Do you see Nicolas Cage ride a bike while he's mad?
No one could look threatening. He's like running around because it's all the bikes, and he's like, you can't ride a bike and look. It's like drinking out of a straw. You look ridiculous no matter how you do it. The Shining, the Stanley Kubrick version, and of course The Manitou, which is amazing.
I think it's Manitou, right?
I don't know.
Is it Manitou?
I don't know.
Is this the alternate Canadian pronunciation?
I don't remember when I saw it. I saw it like a couple years ago.
I think it's the Manitou.
It's got Tony Curtis in it.
Yeah, Tony Curtis and Susan Strasberg and Burgess Meredith.
Yeah. And then You're Next, which we also mentioned. Those were ones that were on the list. Let's just talk real quick. Let's just, prattle on through the ones that are new.
Yeah, we finally rolled the rest out this week after much, much, much teasing and anticipation.
So you talked about Texas Chainsaw.
Hell,
the original.
Yeah.
And this was, let me ask you this. Was this kind of put on the hurry up offense because,
The hurry up offense. Hey, cool. We're running we're doing run and gun now. We're running the no huddle.
Well, no, because you posted on the message board. You're like, hey, would people be interested in this because Marilyn Byrne just passed away? I mean, were you planning on this beforehand because there's the new 4K transfer? Or was it something that you're just like, would be a good tribute?
Here's the chronology. Okay. We knew there was the new 4K transfer out there.
Yeah.
So that's open up pretty much for any time.
Yeah.
And we were thinking, hey, it would be nice to bring it back at some point. It was not foremost on the list that we had originally. But
the last time it played, it's not played for a while.
1999, Nightmare at Studio 35, number one. Yeah. The way we were running things for organizing this was we had a bunch of films, and there were maybe two or three that we really wanted to try to get. But depending on if we could get those, the rest of the lineup could go in several different ways. Because planning these, it's not, especially when you have time, planning these is not just putting things out in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. Ideally, you want to try to book a lineup for what you can get, but what would play well together? And what would I hopefully, although this could be challenging this year, hopefully what would play well as an event?
Mm-hmm.
You know, be able to toss stuff in at each part of the event that would be appropriate for that time, that audience temperament, blah, blah, blah. So Chainsaw was kind of hovering around. After Marilyn Burns died, I put up just a small question on the Facebook page saying, hey, how many of you would be interested in seeing this because there's the new restoration?
Yeah.
And the response considering the average response we get off a Facebook post was really strong.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, I didn't realize there was that much demand or interest for this. But again, it's been 15, 16 years since it showed before. And
it played at the Gateway this summer, but I mean, again, you're not necessarily, it might be a different, totally different people coming to it.
And we have people coming. I mean, I've said it before, but we have such a strong contingent coming from out of the state or out of the city that never gets to see things like this in a theater.
And I'll tell you, it looks good. Because I went and I saw it when I played at the Gateway, and it looks good. The sound's good.
That's that 7.1 mix that they've instituted, isn't it?
My only complaint on it is the sound's almost too good at times that it takes away from the gritty fly on that wall experience.
And when I first heard that they were doing a 7.1 remix, that's what I thought too, was that almost seemed like overkill, but it'll be interesting.
I mean, some parts work really, really well, but there's other parts in particular, the sliding door sequence, we'll say. Oh, yeah. It sounds almost overmixed to me. But
you mean when Gwyneth Paltrow marries the wrong guy?
Yeah, yeah.
I love that part of the film.
When her head's in the box and everything? Yeah. Yeah, amazing. Oh, spoiler alert. There were moments, and I remember I ran into somebody else who works on, you know, film, cult film kind of stuff, and I was talking to him, and he said, yeah, he agreed with me. Mm. But if you've never seen it, it's not going to make a difference. Well, it's just big, but that comes from me watching it on an old tube TV.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and I don't know. I watched maybe about half of it back in 1999 when it was projected. So I don't know what it actually really sounded like in a theater.
Well, what I'll be interested to see too is it's on DCP.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if they'll do this, but if they include multiple audio tracks, if you can have the option to play it in 7.1, or if you can have the option to play it like in two channel stereo or mono.
Because it wasn't even original. It was mono originally.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it's the fun thing about this presentation is that for the first time, they have gone back. Toby Hooper and the guys he was working with, they've gone back to the original 16mm negative.
Toby Hooper and the gang.
Yeah. Toby and the gang sat around one day deep down in Texas, and they've gone back to the 16mm negative for the first time. Even the prints that came out before in theaters. And this, if you know anything about Texas Chainsaw history. And if you don't, I might have to walk out right now. And I'm walking out of the studio in the sky, so that's a long drop down to the ground.
I'll see you later. Bye!
Chainsaw! If you know anything about the history of that, the distributor behind Texas Chainsaw, the original one, was Bryanston International. Bryanston International made quite a bit of money off a little film called Deep Throat.
Hmm.
And they were also highly connected with the porn industry and with the mob, because Butchie Pirano, who was the guy who run it, was a huge member of one of the New York crime families. Mm-hmm. So famously, Deep Throat, it's why most of the principals never saw any. Yeah, I heard too. Most of the principals never saw any money off of that.
Yeah.
And most of the principals behind Texas Chainsaw, any revenue they got, any royalties, were a pittance. If you ever want to read a really great accounting of this, I highly recommend Joe Bob Briggs' book, Profoundly Disturbing, Movies That Shock the World. And the chapter on Texas Chainsaw Massacre is an eye-opener if you know nothing beyond the film. But when they originally had the film...
Yeah, you think artists get screwed today.
Oh, good God.
Good Lord.
And it's not even like you can take them to court. You're going to take the mob to court to get your royalties back from your porn film.
Give me my sucker.
Or your chainsaw movie. Yeah. If you've seen the film before, and if you saw the film...
We're talking about Chainsaw?
Yeah, Chainsaw. Throat. Like, if you saw the film the last time...
Because I've seen both, just to let you know.
Well, good.
And I can talk in authority.
I've seen Inside Deep Throat, the documentary, and I've seen Lovelace, but I've never seen...
Lovelace was bad.
Deep Throat.
But you got to see Amanda Seyfried.
Hey, yeah. And Peter Sarsgaard as Chuck Traynor is wonderfully sleazy.
I wanted him to. I think he and Lawrence Fishburne should get together and do, like, Ike and Chuck as, like, a buddy cop movie.
That would be fun.
That would be amazing. Yeah. Lawrence Fisher would have to lose some weight.
Uh-oh. Calling him out now. This is bad.
I have a show called Fat Guys at the Movies.
Fishburne is, he's going to get on Twitter and probably run you down now.
I'm sure he will.
At Kevin Carr. Hey, Fishburne is coming for you.
Tay Diggs follows me on Twitter. Thank you very much.
Tay Diggs?
Tay Diggs follows me on Twitter.
Whoa!
That guy's nuts.
Great. Tay Diggs is going to hate me now, too.
Tay Diggs.
Well, Tay, if you're listening out there, thank you. So if you've seen Chainsaw Massacre before...
Yes.
What you likely saw was a blow up from the 16mm negative onto 35, which is not the same thing. So, and that's part of what kind of lent it some of that gritty charm. Like the last time that any of us showed it back in 1999 on film, that was, I think, an original release print from Bryanston. Okay. And it gives it part of that charm. And Chainsaw Massacre is a film that's very much built on a documentary realism in terms of its look. But it's not like an ugly film.
Yeah.
If you go the most recent home video incarnation, the Blu-ray that I think Don May at Synapse worked on, parts of it are just really beautiful, especially like when you have some of the exterior scenes
if you compare it to some of the other movies of the time, like Mother and
or
Mother's Day, and I mean these movies like Slugs, these movies that came out or Frogs, those that mm-hmm. came out in the 70s that played on Night Owl Theater. It looks really good compared to some of that crap.
Yeah, so them going back to the original 16mm negative and drawing the print source from that should be a treat. You've seen it. I mean, you've seen the DCP.
Very rich.
So this is kind of like Chainsaw Massacre, like you've never seen it before and heard it before. Now, how that's going to turn out hearing-wise, I don't know.
Now, the other question, this is a sort of...
And by the way, too, I think this is a rarity. I think one of the few times we've ever done this, I realize these Columbus Horror Marathons are all sort of in the same lineage, mm-hmm. but they keep restarting. So if you go by a Shock Around the Clock lineage only, it's one of the few times we've ever shown the sequel before the original. Oh. Because we showed Chainsaw 2 in 2010. Mm. Someone, one of our longtime marathoids, put together a trivia quiz that year, and he knew it off the top of his head, and I knew it after thinking, but we don't have enough time today. But there's like only three or four times in total Columbus Marathon history where we've played a sequel before an original. Mm. So yeah, trivia question for all you out there. Figure it out tonight, and you win a prize. You win...
It's all you, man.
I'll give you a hug at the marathon. I don't know.
So sweet.
I love hugs at the marathon.
Especially if you're a woman. I love the women.
Yeah, boy. Get the shovel out for me. Yeah.
All right. Now, because you were talking Texas Chainsaw, I'm actually going to do a question that I'm probably going to talk about a little bit more in the next marathon chat we do. Are we going to have barbecue available to buy?
It would be fun.
It would be
nice.
We
haven't talked about it a whole lot
yet. Was the barbecue burger, like, patties that are in the drive-in commercials?
Castleberry?
Yeah, can we get Castleberry?
Those aren't patties, my friend.
They're just...
Those are authentic, that's authentic, soft, shredded barbecue. Because if they were patties...
Rendered meat.
You could lay them... Yeah, rendered meat, thank you, I like that. If they were patties, you could lay them on the burger in the trailer. Oh, these are scooped, it's a chunk of processed, rendered beef. Slopped onto a bun.
We live in Columbus, Ohio. We should be able to get our hands on processed rendered beef somewhere.
Castleberry's does sell, let's see, Castleberry sells chili sauce still.
We can get the chili sauce. Yeah. Well, you know, and there's plenty of good barbecue. You don't even, you know, just, but get like, get the, we, you should sell Castleberry or something like Castleberry. Like, call them Castleberry-ish.
It would be fun. Part of it depends on.
All you need is rendered beef and a couple crock pots.
Well, and part of it depends on when we show Chainsaw. If we show it last, that could be redundant at that point.
That would be terrible. Well, but you showed it, and now it could be the grand White Castle epidemic.
I was about to bring up the White Castle epidemic. Our one-time experiment in White Castle something mania. I can't even... It's so beyond words and adjectives and nouns.
Decency.
Too. Yeah. We'll see.
Put that in your hopper. That's what I'm voting for. That.
My hopper. I'll put... There you go. It's in the hopper.
All right, let's move on to the next one that we've also teased. Let's talk about Dario Argento.
Dario? Manitow? Possibly?
Whatever.
Today, it's alternate,
tomato,
it's
tomato.
Alternate pronunciation day on the podcast, kids.
Tenebrae.
Or Tenebrae. Yeah, tenebriated, yeah, as we like to call it.
Tenebriated, yes.
Tenebrae.
Tell me about Tenebrae.
Have you seen Tenebrae?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so
I had it on my list for... I try and watch a horror movie at least one horror movie every day of October.
Yeah.
And I think I had it on my list last year. I just never got around to it.
So if your only experience with Dario Argento, or Armani as someone once referred to it to me, I didn't correct them on that. It's like, wasn't that an Armani film? It's
the
like
Armani
stylish, yes, but
stylish Italian horror.
Dario Argento's Tenebrae. If you've only seen Suspiria, mm-hmm. say. Which we showed last year.
Which we know how much the audience ubiquitously loves Suspiria.
Those who didn't like it last year are deaf now, so too bad. Okay. They can't hear
Suspiria.
Us anyway. If that is your only experience with his films, Tenebrae is quite a change up. Actually, you know, it's the ironic part about his career is that Suspiria, in the grand scale of things, is kind of the anomaly. It's the most, aside from Inferno, it's the most supernatural. It's the most dreamlike, again, except for Inferno, which is also great. But, you know, Argento made his bones making giallos, giallo films, which are named after the yellow paper that these Italian crime novels used to be published on.
Yeah.
And you're getting into his early works like Four Flies on Grey Velvet and Bird with the Crystal Plumage, Cat of Nine Tails, Deep Red. Those are all essentially...
All of those have shown at marathons.
Cat of Nine Tails, okay. No.
But the other three have, because I was there for those. Yeah. Well, no, I don't think I was there for the Deep Red one.
Oh, no, you were there, because we've talked about that so many times. Yeah,
May have been when I was
You got in trouble with a few people for knocking on that nonstop.
I may have gotten
I believe
trouble.
Because your thing was, it's an Argento film. How can you not make fun
That's
of it,
right.
please?
That's right.
Well, you're taking this seriously?
It's the style.
That's actually how he says it, too.
I do.
But all those were essentially crime, thriller, mystery, horror films. I mean, they were much more about here's something gruesome that happens, usually involving someone with a repressed memory, and now you have the protagonist who's caught up in this world trying to figure it out while other people are gruesomely slaughtered around him.
It's That's basically where, what if you go from the EC Comics derivative, it these would be the things that would fall in shock suspense stories rather than Tales from the Crypt.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, yeah. And none of them, as far as I can remember, none of those original early films deal with anything supernatural at all.
Yeah. But the fashions, oh boy.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's that. Well, hey, he's Italian. What can you say?
Mamma mia.
Tenebrae falls into that. Tenebrae is, it's kind of an odd film in some ways because he...
It's an odd film. Yeah, like his other films are completely normal.
I don't even know why we talk about Dario Argento on
these podcasts. His other films are just like... Nicholas Sparks.
Well, okay, say for this, Suspiria is a film in which the art direction, the production design, the set design is so heavily stylized. Mm-hmm. Inferno is the same way. Inferno has a film in which a guy dips his hand into a puddle on the ground, and the puddle actually ends up leading into an underground sub-aquatic chamber in which a corpse is floating around. All seems very, legit. Very highly stylized. Tenebrae, he filmed in Rome in 1982, I think, or 81, 82.
This is Rome, Italy, right?
Rome, Italy, yeah. Not New Rome.
Not down,
although, boy, Tenebrae said in New Rome, lots of speed traps. Hell of a film.
Have you seen the oddest map of Columbus that's been going around?
Yeah. So Tenebrae, he films in Rome with the express desire to capture a lot of the areas of Rome that are much more modernist in architecture. Mm. And also with the intention of, he's often said he wanted to have the implication be that the film was set in the near future, not like a time travel or not like a prophetic
movie.
This is made
in 1982.
Well, and he wanted what he shot
the
to
grand
seem,
world of 1990.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he wanted it to seem kind of slightly more sterile and slightly more off kilter, just in terms of where he shot and the apartments he shot in.
Because future means sterile.
It usually does. Yeah.
If we
found that out through Apple, yeah, sterility is all over the place. And trust me, once your iPhones start transmitting that radiation to your groins, it will be a very sterile future for some of us here. Which is again why I don't put my phone in my pocket.
I have three kids.
Faked the moon landing?
What?
And confessed to it in The Shining
with a sweater.
All will be revealed at this marathon.
So we're not showing Room 237.
No, not yet.
Not yet. It's time for something to fall through.
Anyway. So Tenebrae is set in that, and it's about this almost Stephen King-esque horror/crime author played by Anthony Franciosa, who goes to Rome as part of his book tour. And once he gets there, his major novel, Tenebrae, per the film's title, murders begin to happen, and they're inspired by his book. Oh. And so he's obviously drawn into it, and the police investigate because, hey, you're the guy who, once you landed in town, people start killing people in imitation of things that happen in your book.
It happens.
And in some ways, it's kind of a wry commentary on Argento's own career, and it was partially inspired by his experiences with fans, who could sometimes be a little fanatical.
Yeah, well, that's why they're called fans.
To be brief, but it's partly inspired by that, but it's also... Unlike Suspiria, it's much more of a murder mystery horror film. Now, some of you out there will hear that and go, oh, murder mystery, great. But Tenebrae is also really crazy in a lot of ways.
And It's an early 80s.
Well, if Suspiria is like going down the rabbit hole in a purely fantastical way, Tenebrae is like going down the rabbit hole into insanity. Mm. Even though everything is set in a world that is highly accessible. And it's fun, and it has some of his greatest gore set pieces ever.
Does Goblin do the music?
What's left of Goblin does. I think it's 3/5 of the original Goblin. Mm. Someone will disagree with me and write an angry letter via passenger pigeon.
What the hell's a letter?
To me, yeah.
What's that?
Hopefully we'll get it by the marathon. We can right midway through, we can say, this just in from passenger pigeon, there's a complaint. Let's read it to you.
Is this on 35?
No. I've mentioned it before. We
Blu-ray, DVD?
Tried to move Heaven
and
Earth.
It's on VHS, isn't it? You're going in from YouTube.
It's on beta, actually.
Okay.
It's on YouTube, yes. We're actually going to dial it up. I'll be in the second row with a laptop going, hold on, not this version. No, not this version either. Oh, here we go. This is good, really. It's a little pixelated, but we tried to move Heaven and Earth to show this in 35. We've talked about this before because our guiding philosophy is if there is any way we can get our hands on the best possible version, we'll do it. Now, we're limited. We're not an art center. We're not a museum. We're not a film archive. Mm. We're limited in what we can get. Sometimes, though, there'll be something we really want to show. Case in point, again, from science fiction, Akira. Hmm? We checked around, and to all of our knowledge, there is not a 35mm print that exists of Akira right now, or one accessible by human beings. So we ended up taking the Blu-ray, and we essentially showed that, and it looked fantastic the way that we were able to present it. Tenebrae is another situation. We had knowledge of a close to uncut 35mm print, but we tried everything we could do, and we could not make it work, and we knew there was a very good chance we would not be able to make this work anytime in the near future. And when you reach that point, you think, okay, you want to show this, you can get a hand on a very nice digital copy of it and make it look really nice on the screen. Might as well do it.
So
because we could be chasing after the rainbow for forever.
Pulling off a Blu-ray?
Yeah, it's pulling off of a Blu-ray and doing a little bit of conversion into the same thing we did for Delicatessen and Akira.
Oh, no, but those look great.
Yeah.
And Delicatessen being live action, I think, is a little bit closer to what you're going to expect.
I'll tell you this. Yeah. We have the version, close to the version that we'll show.
Mm-hmm.
And we, before we even decided on showing it, we threw it up on the screen a couple months ago and checked out 10 minutes of it. And it looks really nice.
It's got
what Delicatessen had in that it doesn't have that pure video sheen to it. Part of that is because it's a good transfer, but it looks like something that could be a few steps away from like a phenomenal DCP, say.
Well, and here's the thing, and this is, I know that you're constantly running into this battle with yourselves. Even a 35 is great, but personally, I would rather see either, obviously, a DCP or even a Blu-ray transfer than a really scratchy warped print that's gone red in 35.
Yeah, it's a toss-up in many cases. Sometimes it depends on the film. Sometimes it depends on how bad it is. Well, and again, too.
Well,
I mean,
remember what was the pit in the pendulum? That was so red,
but for the record, that was we were supposed to have that on a new 35 print, and there was a mix-up, and we had to jumble or run around at the last second.
You had the old print that was played at the Drexel.
That was not a case where we said, oh, you know what, we got a red print of Pit in the Pendulum, let's show that, because screw Blu-ray.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, because I as cool as it is to have a film print, if it's not a good film print, I'm personally in favor of seeing it on Blu-ray, especially if it's something that can be an audience piece and something like that.
And there are times. I mean, the studios have been much more erratic about repertory preservation.
Yeah.
And when you start getting into more obscure films, there are films that aren't going to see a DCP release anytime soon. There are films that will not have new 35 prints struck anytime soon. There are films that might have one 35 print, but they'll only loan it out to museums.
Well, it's
or cinematheques. And we're not there yet.
Yeah, it's weird for you to point up the whole thing with Akira, because I'm like, I saw it in the theaters in 35.
I did too. Yeah.
There were prints.
Case in point. Yeah. That's the thing. I saw Akira in 35 as recently as 2002.
Hmm.
And that shows you how things have changed. Unfortunately, you've had 10, 15 years of, number one, people not taking care of prints. Mm-hmm. I have seen cases, you know, having worked projection in my life, I've seen cases where, say, when I was working in area theaters and we had a decent, fairly new print of a film, Carrie. Case in point, Carrie. There was a decent
the
Sissy Spacek one. This was
but the one that then they struck new prints of it. No, they didn't, because I saw it at Studio 35 and it looked terrible back in like 2000.
We showed it at Studio 35 in 2001. It was in 16mm. And that's the case I'm referring to, actually. We had a 35mm print booked of Carrie for that 2001 marathon. And they had struck a new print maybe a year and a half before. No. We got the call 2 weeks beforehand that their print was now unplayable because people, projectionists along the way, had messed it up. And that, you know, that's awful that something like that, people could be so careless as to junk a print like that was fairly new and in good shape. Yeah, so we had to show Carrie in 16mm because that was our only option at that point.
Okay. Because so, I saw that there. Yeah, because it didn't look good.
Part of it is that. Part of it is you've got, you know, when there are prints available to more theaters, oftentimes people don't take care of them, and they end up getting messed up, and then they're gone. But also, more and more...
When you have fewer and fewer people who are good at doing projection, because you don't have to do prints anymore.
Part of that, too, yeah. And there's a very, you know, thriving, in its own way, thriving scene in repertory theaters around the country. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes, studios will only make, say, one new copy of a new print. And they'll be very selective about who they give it to. Case in point, Nosferatu, the vampire. Our good friend Brian Block from Bleeding Light Film Group. Several years ago, we showed their new print of Possession. Mm-hmm. But that was their one print of Possession.
And that looked good.
And the only reason we could show that was because at the time, we had the projection capabilities to do it.
Yeah.
We don't quite have those right now, even though the projection capabilities we have are great. And so they have a print, a film print of Nosferatu, but we have to show the DCP. Now, you know, knowing them too, you know, their DCPs are nice too. It's not like they're cheap. But studios, like big studios, we're talking about a guy who's kind of like a very small operation. Big studios oftentimes, if they make a new 35 print of something, they might only make one print. And their commitment to that end of the repertory game is waning greatly because, you know, digital's the way of the future for them, hopefully in a better way. So, yeah.
Well, and you've even got, what was it, Paramount? Is it Paramount that's...
Paramount won't...
Completely won't make film prints at all?
Paramount stopped making film prints, and their repertory division, I believe they still have a limited number of classic titles on film that they will lend out. They reorganized that a couple years ago. But even that, it's like, if you want to book Rosemary's Baby, you can do it. Mm-hmm. If you want to book something slightly more obscure, you have to just get your own print or show it on video.
Yeah.
So it's getting harder and harder. And when Dario Argento, like we've talked about before, it's amazing in a country like this that's so wild about horror films that a guy like him, who's kind of like almost the Italian Alfred Hitchcock, that it's so hard. You would figure someone, some company, somewhere, some foundation would say, we're going to commit to making an uncut 35 print or two, and high-quality DCPs of all of Argento's films, we will do that. And it's such a scattershot game trying to get that. So that's a roundabout way of saying it's tough out there.
It's on Blu-ray.
It's hard out there being a pimp, man.
Staying on the Dario Argento.
Mike, as we like to call him. Those of us who are friends.
Mike Armani. Let's talk about Demons.
A marathon favorite. So Demons has shown once before at the second Incredible Two-Headed Marathon in 2005, and it showed last, so many people might not remember
it. Was it the very last one?
Very last film.
Okay. I was thinking that the last horror.
That was number one. That was 2004.
Oh, okay.
Demons, if you haven't seen it, is just lots and lots and lots of fun, and it's a great film.
He didn't direct it, though. He just
Argento produced it. Lamberto Bava, son of Mario Bava, the godfather of Italian horror, directed it. And it's actually in a very odd twist, or maybe an odd connection, when you watch Room 237, the opening scenes of Room 237, where they have the footage of the camera panning over an audience in a movie theater, that's from Demons. So maybe we should show Room 237. Maybe we should
Let's just announce that now and just see how many people.
We're going to show Room 237. Start the rumors on social media because it's coming, baby. Bonus feature. We're going to say, hey, everybody, you want to see Demons? You really do? Well, you'll have to stay after because we're showing Room 237 first.
Or maybe you can just have people come up and offer their insane theories of another movie, like, you know, Nosferatu. That it means...
I'm sure there would be a lot of insane theories.
Werner Herzog faked the moon landing.
He did. Yeah. That's his ultimate trick, see? Kubrick took the heat, but Herzog, he's German. What do you expect? The Germans are always faking moon landings. They did it back in, like, 25, and I think in 71, and...
What?
It always happened, yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. Demons is tons of fun, and it's such a simple setup. People go to a movie theater. I think it's in Berlin, if I'm correct.
It's been so long since I saw it, and like you said, it was the last movie in the lineup. And
I've said this before.
Blurry.
I straddle the line way too much between organizer of event and participant in the event, because one of the nice things about the modern marathons is Bruce and I can sit down and watch the movies with everybody, and it's fun, and you know, it's better than running around in the back the whole time. But sometimes you run into weird spots where you think, oh, I want to really enjoy this, so I don't want to remind myself too much of this film beforehand. Hence, Demons, where I forget where the theater is, but I thought it was in Berlin.
Sure.
People go to this theater, and Demon Possession breaks out, and it's wild and gruesome. Yeah, there we go.
Gruesome
and gory and all sorts of great stuff. And there's lots of heavy metal and motorcycles and boobs. Perfect film to play. And
there's some boobs in there.
I think so, if I remember correctly. Yeah, perfect film to play either in the middle of the night or later on or at last or something like that. So I'm really looking forward to that. And it would be fun to see it with a, you know, hopefully more of the crowd in attendance at that time. And there's a whole new generation of people who've picked it up in the last 10 years, the marathon that is.
Yeah.
That I think they'll dig it too.
Yeah, I think it's a fun movie. It's is that going to be on a print?
Yes. Yeah, thank you for reminding me. In 35 millimeter. I should just start saying a rare 35 millimeter screening for everything.
Yeah,
because
why not?
They are getting rare.
Speaking of rare,
medium rare.
It is mentioned erotic and incredibly rare. We are of course talking about
The Satanist.
Oh, I was going to say Winnie the Pooh's
Heffalump. Winnie the Pooh's Heffalump Adventure.
Heffalump Halloween.
Puss in Boots, as I teased on the
Why
Facebook page.
Why are you not showing Puss in Boots? When I saw that, I was like standing up and cheering, and then I'm like, "Oh, he was joking." Bastard.
I'm
Puss
so
in
sad.
Boots looks insane.
Okay, here brief tangent on that. Bruce has a 35 print of, I think it's not that Puss in Boots, but it's a similar Puss in Boots.
Similar
kids movie of the era in which there's a guy dressed up in a full-length adult cat costume.
Yeah.
He forced me to watch a reel one day of that movie, and it's... I'm feeling weak in the knees just having to think about it now.
Could you show Puss in Boots and then like play the soundtrack to Human Centipede 2?
Sure.
That would be amazing.
Sure, anything for you,
yes,
kid.
Yes, do that.
Please.
That is what's happening at the moment.
Only if you play the guy from Human Centipede 2, the lead character, and you sit in front of the screen the whole time and just look very sweaty and voyeuristic.
I sit in front of the screen to look sweaty all the time anyways. Do you need me to go walk around to everybody, tie him up, and put him ass to mouth in line and go...
Keep talking, really. I think we're getting a lot out today. That's
what I should do.
Valuable information.
That's the only lines he says. He says nothing except...
He doesn't, no. Yeah. The rare 35 film, as we've buried the lead completely and then shoveled dirt on top of it and built a house on top of it and an Indian burial ground on top of that, is...
Wait, we built an Indian burial ground on top of the house?
And then the house on top of
that.
So
the house, the people who are in the house are going to come back and haunt the Indians who
are
buried in there?
We're in the studio in the sky, so with the burial ground, could we possibly build that underneath the studio in the sky?
As
it would
above,
be on
so
top
below
of the house?
Kind of thing?
Yeah, sure, sure. The incredibly rare 35 millimeter screening we have is Zoltan G. Spencer's The Satanist. Mm. You might ask yourself, what is The Satanist? Well, we have very little knowledge of this film. The quick story is Zoltan Spencer was an exploitation filmmaker in the 60s. And in 1968, he made this film called The Satanist.
Yeah.
What we've managed to gather is this film was pitched toward a... shall we say, adult audience. Not hardcore pornography, but kind of softcore thrills mixed with occult / Satanist material.
How similar to, like, Flesh for Frankenstein? The uncut version. Well, wait, the cut version that we saw. I mean, in terms of, like, hardcore, softcore.
Oh.
Are we just talking, like, lots of boobs and butts? Is that all it is?
I am only going off of what I've heard.
Are we talking, like, Caligula?
I'm only going off what I've heard.
Okay.
This film was thought to be lost for 50 years, as in, you'll never see it.
Mm.
No prints exist. No video exists. It's a rarity. And one of our sources managed to find... A 35 print of what was thought to be lost. It has screened, to my knowledge, again, I could be wrong about this, it has screened once in the past 50 years, and that was in Philadelphia about a month ago. Now, if you really want to go and read the reports about that, you can go and read that online. Hmm. Personally, I'd rather wait because it's such an unknown quantity at this point.
But from what I know,
it is lots of... semi-softcore erotic coupling mixed with a story about an author and his wife moving into a new house, and he's frustrated with his career, and the folks next door who I just happened to be in a cult try to recruit husband and wife to their nefarious demonic, sexy ways.
The
and it's only about 65 minutes, so yeah. It probably doesn't wear out its welcome.
On IMDb, it says people who like this also like Night of a Thousand Cats. So that's something.
That's a ringing endorsement. I like that. Although it does not have Hugo Stiglitz in it.
No, it
unfortunately.
Does not. And then it also says for their summary. A young couple's marriage becomes threatened when an attractive female occultist enters their lives, enticing them into a strange world of drugs, sex, and satanic rites.
I couldn't say it any better. What more do you need? That does hit all the general points.
So boobs.
And yeah, this we hype things up a lot, but this is probably...
This will be the cuckoo patrol of this marathon.
No. Well, that's... That's so reductive. Come on, that's I'll be looking back on
sure
this.
Somebody's
like,
doing the Freddy in this.
I don't know what this will be. It's a really good question. We just thought when we heard what we knew about it, and that it was so rare that this would be something the audience would dig. It is probably a once in a lifetime 35mm screening of this film, unless you want to travel around if it plays anywhere else.
Are you going to actually? Watch it, we'll probably check the reels to make sure they work, but are you going to watch any of it, or are you going to, just experience this with everybody?
Oh, God, no. I'd much rather experience it with everybody.
So you're all going to be like Captain Kirk in Star Trek 4 when Spock goes in the whale tank. He's just like, oh, God. Oh, dear.
Sure. Oh,
God. Just watching this.
I don't know. I really don't know what to expect. I mean, I know a little more what to expect.
Are
now,
we all going to die during this? I mean, is this something because it wasn't screened? Because is this like The Ring? Is this like the videotape of The Ring that it's disappeared for years, and then you're going to show it, and then the zombie apocalypse will start in Bexley, Ohio?
There will be no refunds.
Why would we
just
care?
To emphasize that at that point?
Why would we care?
But we're going to run away with the cash to Sweden. And
make sure the
all.
Castleberries are there, so zombies will eat that. Because I'm sure there's human flesh in there somewhere.
Sure, the Satanist might quite possibly trigger all of those things. It might bring on the apocalypse. Although it's screened in Philadelphia, and they're still there.
That's Philly.
Yeah, they're tough though.
Yeah,
not like Columbus.
I don't know.
So no, I'm not going to watch it before I watch it with that audience, and I look forward to it. Well, and it's fun. I mean, you talked about
you're not going to thread it through the projector, and suddenly it's going to be like Never Been Kissed.
I hope not.
Okay.
And then it'll melt into Fight Club.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I the farther along we go in these events, the greater value something rare or something underseen takes on.
Yeah.
I sound like Shatner now.
Takes on
importance for you. Yeah, there's a bigger draw towards things people haven't seen or things people almost never seen or people haven't seen in a long time. So that's a huge reason why we booked The Satanist, for the rarity, for the lost aspect of it. Mm-hmm. I'm under no illusion that this is lost Orson Welles footage. Although I love how the lost Orson Welles footage is for a film called Too Much Johnson. Hey!
Distributed by the people who brought you Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is my new film.
Sounds like
this
class.
This is Orson Welles here.
It's time for
Too Much Johnson. Here's Joseph Cotton. Say hello, Joe. He's had way too much Johnson, obviously.
The whole 9 inches, balls deep.
This is it's a genuine rarity, and I think that's a large part why we booked this. And I think it's it should be fun. I think the audience will have a good time with it.
Sounds good.
And thankfully, it's not 2.5 hours long, so I think we'll be.
Yeah.
If it's heaven forbid, if it's not that good, it'll be over.
It'll be done quickly.
Soon after, yeah.
All right, let's move on. Now we are into the Ohio premieres.
Yes.
And there are three titles, one's short.
And these are fairly legitimate. It's not like, hey, here's something that has just, that you can find on any source for the last 8 months, and now we finally brought it in. Now, to be fair, we've talked about this before, but premieres have gotten tougher to get for many reasons. Just kind of the nature of the game at this point.
Yeah.
We kind of had a pledge a few years ago, especially in 2012 when we showed Kill List and The Last Circus, that we would try our damnedest to get some kind of premiere or pseudo-premiere or two. But if we couldn't, we would gladly show something from the previous year or so that not many people had seen.
Yeah.
Your Next is a big case with that.
Yeah.
But Kill List was even more so. I mean, I was shocked when we showed Kill List that a good 80-85% of the audience, when we did a straw poll, had not seen Kill List at that point. And I think it was even on, it had just come out on Blu-ray around the time we showed it.
Just because it's out on Blu-ray doesn't mean people have all gone out and seen it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, but this year we actually have several films that are legitimate premieres. And in one case is the first, not the first Midwest screening, but at least the first Ohio screening anywhere of this. So let's speak about that one first, because I think it's
which one
it's
is that?
The most interesting. Michael Lennox, Red Luck.
If you now, this is the short, right?
This is the short film, yeah. Michael Lennox is a local filmmaker, local experimental filmmaker, and a pal of ours, longtime pal, and a longtime Marathoid, too. He's been coming to these things for quite a long time, and he does a mean impersonation of Ronnie the Z-Man Barzell from Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which is where good. I first met him at our Psychorama Fest when we played that many years ago. And he won the...
make a lot of money doing
he, that. Yeah, he, we did, yeah, yeah. He won the BVD imitation contest by being Z-Man Barzell.
Nice.
So Mike has been making films on his own for a long time. And most of Mike's films play around with the concept of films themselves. For instance, he made a short film. I forget the name, so I'm a bad advocate slash fan. But he actually traveled on a train, and he would talk to strangers, and he would ask them if they would recreate scenes from Hitchcock's Strangers on a Train with him. So literally, it was Strangers on a Train performed by strangers on a train. He did a mashup, a layover of Gus Van Sant's Psycho and Hitchcock's Psycho, superimposing them on each other to show how, A, it's not a shot-by-shot or shot-for-shot remake, but B, how odd little similarities and odd little like things that coincidences match up in having them both playing at the same time. He directed a really cool film that he showed at the Wexner Center last year.
Spaceboy
was cool too. I'm burying the lead on this one too.
I'm sorry.
He directed this really cool feature film called All the Memory in the World. Showed it at the Wexner Center last October.
Yeah.
And All the Memory in the World is all about photography and film. As in, he spent the better part of a couple years with help from a couple co-conspirators getting footage from films in which a photograph was shown in a film or photographs were shown in film. And to even try to describe it would not do it justice, but it's kind of a reflection too on I think he pitched it as like a reflection on an insomniac's memory and love of film and photography. And it was one of my favorite films I saw last year, and I don't just say that because Mike's a friend. It was such a truly original, compelling piece of work, and it was about something we all know, which is movies and pictures and how those play together, sometimes in the most interesting ways possible. And here we go. Mike also remade Marathon. I'll call this Marathon should-be favorite Spaceboy 4 or 5 years ago. And he was Spaceboy, and his one of his old teachers in, I think, grade school played the woman, the Florence Marley part.
Okay.
Showed it at Science Fiction Marathon. Mike appeared for that. This, however, Red Luck, which is the 25-minute short film that he'll be showing at this year's Horror Marathon. Red Luck, I'm tempted to say, is his first original film that he's made.
Okay.
And, again, here's the mystical cell. Trying to describe Red Luck and what it is probably wouldn't do it justice. It's a horror film. It's his first truly horror film that he's made. It's very much, when you watch it, I think you'll see there are tributes to a lot of other genres and styles of horror films, specifically from the 60s on. It's kind of a story about a killer. It's kind of a story about repressed memories. It's kind of a story about...
Photographs.
No. I thought you said bluegrass.
No, I don't think it's about
bluegrass.
It's Yeehaw.
And it's very, very stylish. I mean, we kind of have a mini Italian theme going on in this marathon.
Okay.
If you wanted to say that Mike pays tribute to some Italian horror films in this, you wouldn't be that far off.
Okay. And we know how much you like Italian horror films.
It's very gorgeous too. I mean, it's incredibly beautiful, and it's strange and mysterious and. And I dug it. When Mike offered it to us, he let us watch it beforehand, and I was very enthused by it.
Cool.
And if you really hate Mike for some reason, if you do, we probably shouldn't talk. But if you hate Mike, the film, it's 25 minutes. It's not too long. But Mike will be there to introduce the film. He'll do a Q&A afterwards. We're pretty excited about it because he's a longtime supporter of these things. And it's a very unique opportunity. And it is the first Ohio screening of this film. So we're kind of proud of that.
Excellent. So we'll have to see that.
Other premieres. We'll lead right into The Strange Color of Your Body's Tears.
Yes. which has boobs on the poster.
Which is truly a tribute to Italian horror. So this is the French filmmaking
team. So this is definitely a theme going on in this marathon.
Repressed.
You love Italian horror.
Well, Italian horror, part and parcel of a lot of Italian horror, is repressed memories.
Can we get meatballs and spaghetti?
I thought you were going to say, could we get Meatballs, the movie?
No, that's... No.
Ladies and gentlemen, Meatballs!
We are the CIT's obedience.
Yeah.
What's funny? The poster that you have posted on the website...
For Strange Color.
For Strange Color has the booby and nipple. But if you go to IMDb, it is the radio safe version.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I had a little mini debate about that for the flyer, because that's such a great piece of art. I think on the flyer I have the slightly censored version, just in case. The website, I figure people are going to... Although, considering what else is on the flyer, I'm guessing like 5-year-olds won't pick it up.
This is... This won't be the first time boobs have been leaked out on the internet this week.
That's a timely joke, my friend.
Wah, wah. So here's...
People will be listening to this on archive someday and say...
What?
What?
No, because there's always going to be...
Nudity was leaked on the internet? Get out of here.
Always happens. There'll be always something. Nah, you know who doesn't have to worry about
nudity? By that point, they'll be saying, oh, the internet. I remember that. That was so fun.
Here's the thing. I have terabytes of nude photos of myself stuck on the cloud. No one's hacked yet. Get with the program.
Get with it, folks. That's high quality nudity there. A lot of flesh to pass around.
That's right.
So The Strange Color of Your Body's Tears. Okay, so the filmmaking duo of Hélène Cattè and Bruno Forzani, French pair who directed a little film back in 2010 called Amer, A-M-E-R, as in love. And Amer was also... Oh. Very somewhat similar, if you've seen it, in that it was a tribute to a lot of the images and tropes and themes of foreign horror films.
Yeah.
Heavy on Italian in some ways. If you've seen Amer and you didn't quite dig it, from what I can gather, you might like Strange Color of Your Body's Tears, because it trades in the same type of storytelling skills. It's very surreal, and I mean, there is a story per se, but it's kind of like extreme nightmare logic taken to the nth degree.
Oh, okay.
But from what I understand, Strange Color of Your Body's Tears has a lot more explicit violence, sex, all the little, you know, the signposts along the way, the easy hooks that will get you into this. You can watch the trailer online, and it looks just... I hesitate to say mind-blowing, because, you know, I'm not one to hype things beyond what they are.
Okay.
But let's just say mind-blowing, mind-shredding, mind-ripping.
Oh, wow, that's even worse.
Mind-annihilating.
Not to oversell.
Well, what's the pull quote in the trailer? I think I forget who it's from, but they say you will never be the same again.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that was Ain't It Cool News who said that, or maybe Twitch.
Yeah, it could be.
I don't know. One of them gave the great quote that said you will never be the same again after seeing this, and that it's.
It wasn't Pete Hammond from BoxOffice.com or something.
I don't think so.
It wasn't another winner from Rob Schneider.
It wasn't.
You'll never be the same again.
It wasn't 60-second review from Jeff Craig or. What was Sin City 2? Did you see the ads for Sin City 2?
No.
The national ad. I was in California when Sin City 2 came out, and I saw the ads, and the main pull quote was from the Culver City News.
Yeah.
I came home to see the national paper, the New York Times, and it was the same ad. It was like from the Culver City News. Like, wow, you got to be stretching at this point. That's the best quote you can get.
Damn movie. That's the problem. That's the Weinsteins. They're a bunch of assholes.
I don't know how you can't like Sin City 2.
Sin City 2 is good.
Ava Green spends half the movie.
Lots of boobs.
In the birthday suit.
Yeah.
Drive-in Academy Award. I drive-in Academy Awards for Ava Green and for Powers Booth in that movie. If they still had those,
they would
be robbed.
I like the fact that Stacey Keach played a Santarin.
Yes.
From Doctor Who.
Yeah. One of the great walk-on roles in modern cinema. Stacey Keach is
cartoonish
blob guy.
Yeah, I mean, what's so funny is it wasn't like the Star Wars cantina scene where everybody was weird.
It was just him.
Normal tuxedo evening gown. What the hell is that thing?
In Sin City, even fat, bloated monsters have their place.
Like, we are from the Centauran Empire.
Yeah. So there's a great quote in the trailer for Strange Color of Your Body's Tears that says, like, strange, sexy, and deeply, deeply disturbed. Wow. So quotes alone, I mean, that's got to sell it in some ways.
There we go. Now, is this on film, or is it going to be digital?
This is digital, yeah. Pretty much, almost every premiere you're going to get. Almost anything new is going to be digital.
They're not striking prints for these things.
Yeah, it's on DCP.
All right, let's talk about the last one here, because we're...
We're running out of time?
Well, we're at, we got plenty of time.
Oh, okay.
An hour, 10 minutes, though.
So. Oh, wow. Oh, yeah, and we still have to talk about your event.
Yeah.
Your event.
Let's talk, last one, Housebound.
Housebound. Housebound is from New Zealand. Peter Jackson loves it.
Okay.
And any of you who've hung out with Peter Jackson, like obviously we have many times here at the studio at the Sky, know Peter Jackson doesn't just love everything except for food and hobbits.
He struggles with that one.
And money, sweet, sweet money. Peter Jackson.
I can't even. I'm like, you're already just heaping on to Peter Jackson. What am I supposed to do? Just get words? And he's stupid.
I'm thinking of. I wasn't trying to heap on him. I love Peter Jackson. I just had this image all of a sudden of Peter Jackson as Uncle Scrooge swimming in his vault of money.
Swimming in money, eating a turkey leg, you know, molesting a hobbit at the same time.
Wow, jeez.
He said he loves hobbits.
Boy. It's
not an underage hobbit. It's just.
No wonder Elijah
they're
Wood.
Small.
No wonder Elijah Wood looks so haunted and damaged
the
after he made the Lord of the Rings films.
The hobbits would do really well in, like, porno.
No, I applaud Peter Jackson. I love Peter Jackson.
I like how you just like ran away from that statement as fast.
Come on, why? Yeah, you know we got to play good cop, bad cop on this thing, don't we? Yeah. Peter Jackson called Housebound bloody brilliant, and it's received very good notices on the festival circuit. Mm. It's a haunted house comedy. Mm. Although it, from what we have been told by our source for the film, it also is genuinely kind of eerie and strange and. Mm. And deeply, deeply disturbed. I'm just going to describe it.
Is it mind-blowing and mind-blowing,
mind-annihilating? It's a rarity. It's not on 35mm, sorry. But
that's okay.
We got the pitch from one of the guys who handled part of the production from New Zealand.
Yeah.
And checked out the trailer and asked around, and it seemed pretty cool. And it's another one that should, as far as I know, be the legitimate Ohio premiere of this film.
Nice.
And sounds like fun. And it's something, too, that's, you know, in parts a little more whimsical and lighthearted. Although, from what
Which
I've seen...
Which we can use. I mean, this is a pretty dour list. I mean, when you've got...
Have you seen The Manitou?
Oh, yeah. No, I love
Come
the
on.
No, I
There's
love
nothing
that.
Dour about The
nothing
Manitou.
Nothing dour, but no. You got, like, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Nosferatu, of Aratu, The Wicker Man, The Shining.
Wicker Man's a fairly funny film in its own very dryly
The Nicolas Cage version is way more
way.
Funny. Now, You're Next, I find a laugh riot. I loved...
You're Next is a lot of fun. Yeah.
You're Next is a lot of fun. And
The Invisible Man is very darkly humorous.
Yeah.
We've talked about that.
No, yeah. I think The Invisible Man...
The odd thing is, we had a concern booking these last six films of having... too many
Italian
humorous
art.
Films
oh,
and
really?
Italian films too, yeah. And then we said, ha, please.
Italians.
Nobody can ever have enough Italian films.
That's what you need. You need for the concessions, you need to bring in Castleberries and like the spaghetti shop or like, you know, just noodles and...
Boy, that suggestion was given by a longtime ally/friend of ours on the message board.
I think it's a great suggestion.
But Housebound, I mean, we thought it would be a good addition, especially in the premiere... the premiere section of the lineup.
Mm-hmm.
Strange Color of Your Body's Tears seems to be very intense and kind of brutal in its own way. So Housebound was a nice counterbalance to that, in that it seems like it's a little funnier. Although, who knows? People might find Strange Color to be a laugh riot. I don't know.
Now, the one question I have, just for myself, I'm bringing my kids.
Yeah.
Liam's 13, Ben's 11. You know, obviously, they've seen some pretty... crazy stuff because I'm their dad. And
I was going to say, your kids are not the target audience. And
your
kids are the target audience. They're not the best litmus test.
But, I mean, there are certain things I would draw the line. Like, if we were in past marathons, I obviously made Liam go home for Flesh for Frankenstein and
13
a Serbian
Ghosts.
Film.
And
yes, it's 13 Ghosts. It's just terrifying. The ghost viewer, you can still see him. Oh my God. But
that's too bad. He had to go home for Flesh for Frankenstein because
he didn't miss anything.
He saw that he would have seen the family friendly
version.
That's
what happens with sex. Yeah, it's that fast.
Wow.
At least the first time it happens and then you get better at it.
Gee, Dad. That was disappointing.
But, like, I wouldn't have let him see Irreversible.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't have let him see Martyrs.
Yeah, it's understandable.
You know, I mean, there's certain things. Is there anything? I mean, obviously, The Strange Color of Everybody's Tears, if it's got, boobs are fine. But, like, it's the big thing I worry about a lot of times is sexual assault and over drug use, like that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just asking for the sake of anyone bringing children.
I haven't seen Strange Color, so I'm not
Are there any big rape scenes in these movies?
Well, I have to look at the list.
Oh, okay.
Now that you're asking about
I'm just checking.
The whole lineup.
Because I took Liam to see Texas Chainsaw, and he liked it.
Oh, the 74 version. Yeah. Well, yeah. That's the beauty about Texas Chainsaw. It's not. Oh, my battery's low.
He was going for a PG rating.
Yeah, it's not a graphic, gory film.
Yeah.
When they did the remake, it was the ridiculous part of the press campaign was the producer saying, oh, well, it's not going to be a gore fest like the original. And then it's 10 times as gory as the original. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure the Satanist has plenty of sex in it, but I'm sure it's ridiculous and silly.
From what I understand, Satanist is more softcore than deeply explicit.
And I've seen, like, Wicker Man, and I'm just curious on this stuff. Like, Manitou has some sexual stuff, but it's goofy.
Oh, Manitou. Yeah. If you were offended by Manitou, might be an American Indian. And even that, I mean, that's the...
Yes, because we know how notorious British the American Indians are.
Well, yeah.
I know what you were saying. It just came out very weird.
Let's see. Looking at the list, I don't know. I mean, the only one I can think of that potentially could have more of that in terms of, like, sex.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't mind sex.
Oh, you mean explicit violence?
I'm talking about, like, violent sex.
I don't know.
I was curious.
I don't know if there's anything that pops out. I don't think there's an 8-minute rape scene in any of these, as far as I know. But
except for Invisible Man.
Except for the Invisible Man.
But he was invisible.
That's the plot line from League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the comic book, when the Invisible Man appears. Have you ever read the comic book?
No, I didn't. It's also the plot from Hollow Man.
Yeah. Well, the League in the comic book, they go to this girls' school in which it's like a religious girls' school in which these girls are they're experiencing the Immaculate Conception over and over again, and they think that there's some kind of weird spiritual miracle going on.
Nope, just a rapey invisible man.
That's what it turns out to be. And yeah, they turn out, and in one scene, they hear this someone being assaulted at night, and they run into the room, and they see this girl suspended in midair, and it's the invisible man has been hiding out at this girls' school, having his way with these girls, and that's how it all happened. And other things happen after that. So, but in terms of a big flashpoint for that, I don't know. I mean, the only film that I have not seen in here that might have some stronger content, but from what I gather, is it's not like an 8-minute rape scene, A Strange Color of Your Body's Tears. Everything else is either fairly well known or got a regular MPAA rating. Your Next, there's some nasty stuff that goes on, but it got rated R. It's not.
Yeah, but even then, Your Next is it's more violence than anything else. Well, and the other reason I do ask is because as the kids get older and need to go into high school, you know, get in a 15 or 16 year old, you wouldn't be bad to have a couple 15 or 16 year olds at least getting into this, because then maybe you'll get
thought
participants later in life.
Yeah, when I say kids, it's like, preteen. We have an okay chunk of teens. Yeah. Mostly what we end up getting anymore are the 17 to 21 year olds. That's about the prime age when they start coming to this if they're new.
Yeah.
For one reason or another. Which is fine too, you know. Sure. I mean, it's the which do you want? Do you want more of that age, or do you want like the old Drexel North days when you had teenagers from Watterson running rampant and tearing down drinking fountains and throwing things in the crowd? And you're like, great to have their money, but they make the event a pain in the ass.
Yeah, throwing things in the crowd, as I pointed out, was a sci-fi event.
Yeah, well, and there was a what was it? Scott Cozzolino had this happen to him. There was a paper cup with ketchup and mustard mixed in it that someone, I think a teen, chunked into the audience at Horror 1992. Hit him. To this day, if Scott sees mustard, he passes out.
Really?
Oh, I wasn't supposed to say that. I'm sorry.
Maybe we can get him mustard and noodles for
moving right along to the
shall we move on? I mean,
the good stuff.
We got let's say, what are we at? We are at a time. It's about an hour and a half. We're 90 minutes into this podcast.
You want to quickly talk about why don't we quickly talk about your event?
Yeah, sure.
And if people couldn't give two shits about your event, they can tune out
now.
So for those of you who are going to turn the podcast off now, love you. Thanks for tuning in.
Yeah.
Dario Argento. That's all I can say with that. So Kevin, you want to give the background of your event, as I like to call it, the Joan F. Memorial Tribute event?
Well, I started doing movie marathons. I do binge watching movies with my kids. I started in 2012. We watched all the James Bond movies over the course of a week. And we sort of made a little event about it. And it started out with us just watching all 22 James Bond movies. And my wife like made snacks for us, and it took a week to do.
Your kids became hardcore misogynists after that week.
That's right. They were smoking and playing Baccarat and all that good stuff. Oh. So you know, we've done other marathons. We did Alien and Predator, and we did Planet of the Apes last year. We did Lucas Filmathon, and we started doing our own 24-hour movie marathons. We did Sci-Fi, and we've sort of settled on dates for ours. And even though part of it is we don't want to conflict with anything going on in October and doing like two weekends in a row of 24-hour movies, that's rough. So
for the week, possibly.
Yeah. So we ended up doing our 24-hour horror movie marathon on Labor Day weekend.
Yeah.
And since Joe has been an inspiration, we let him come by. Well, and there's not a whole lot of room in the basement.
No.
That's the thing.
And the funny thing is, tiny. As those of you, like the two of you that are really hardcore listeners and just remember all these things will know, when I got my start in organizing marathons per se, doing three things just like this, three horror marathons in sister/friends' basements and doing the same thing Kevin is doing now and programming them and making programs and flyers and inviting people. And so I got to, I was called away on official business this weekend after a few movies, but I got to come in and experience a couple of them. And it was a great delight seeing someone else not only put on a marathon I had nothing to do with, but experiencing the video horror marathon get up and yeah, what you did with it was
we go down
pretty
our basement.
Awesome.
We decorated and I got programs. I built printed out slick program nice, mm-hmm. you know, regular programs. We had a certificate at the end and we had a Hall of Fame. By the way, Tom Atkins' mustache won for being in Halloween 3.
Begin the writing campaign for the shock around the clock Tom Atkins mustache vote.
That's right. So we had Joe there. We also showed 13 Ghosts using the original Illusiono. Mm-hmm. I made ghost viewers for everybody. That worked incredibly well. And yeah, so I also do trailer blocks in front of them. And,
oh, those were fun.
And I have finally, you know, resorted to downloading stuff off of YouTube, and I can put them all in like MP4s on a flash drive on the side of my TV, and just it plays straight through. You don't know what's coming up next.
Yeah,
it's really kind of cool.
Yeah, it is.
I used to, originally, I when I first did them, I was using Roku, and I was using an app called Twonky, which I had a program in each one.
Oh, that's a great name.
And the problem is it would tell you what was coming up next. And then I started using Chromecast and using YouTube playlists, but you ran into the same issue where it told you what it was playing.
Yeah.
And if there was any problems with the Wi-Fi or sometimes the YouTube videos wouldn't play or they'd be pulled for mm-hmm. copyright violation. So I just download them. And
so you committed copyright violation all on your own.
Well, no, I'm just downloading them for personal use. I'm not redistributing these. But yeah, so we did that and we invited Joe. It was like I said, we had just a little bit of it. You weren't even in a very comfortable seat. You were just kind of in a folding chair.
That's how I like it though. Yeah.
So, and we showed cartoons and trailers, but he was there for House of Frankenstein.
Yes, which I'd never seen before.
Which is ridiculously bad, but fun. And of course, Halloween 3 Season of the Witch, you got called out during that one.
Yeah, I was there for about 20 minutes of that. Yeah. I'd love to go back and rewatch that too, because I've only seen that once.
It was kind of dumb when it came out, but it's aged incredibly well for just the cheesy John Carpenter staple of work, even though Tom Lee Wallace directed it.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
Most definitely.
But then unfortunately you missed 13 Ghosts.
I did.
So you didn't get to see Illusiono.
But I did follow along at home and did the triple feature that night around the time when you guys would have been doing it of John Dies at the End, the 1958 Fly, and Horror Express.
Three fun movies.
They were. I had seen John Dies beforehand, and there's a very close friend of the marathon, who I will not name, who keeps bugging us to show John Dies at the End at some time. I still think what I thought the first time around about the movie itself, which is that there are parts of it that are very, very enjoyable. There are parts that are a little too clever by a half step.
Mm-hmm.
And there are parts, and I know this might be being picky. Sorry, my chair just
exploded.
Reclined. Hey. Don Coscarelli is shooting on a low budget, obviously, and digital video is the parlance of the realm these days when it comes to that. There are parts in John Dies at the End that definitely look nice because of that, but there are parts too, like some of the things in the apartments or the hotel rooms, where it just it looks cheap. You know, it looks like this has that DV video sheen on it, and it
starts
it's got,
to look like a TV production.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of the curse in some ways of digital and HD. Is in the old days, if you had to shoot on film, you could have something low budget, but there'd at least be like a little bit of a veneer of
it just looked good.
Respect. Yeah. Whereas even the best HD, if you're on a low budget, can look a little cheap.
Well, part of the thing is the way film was, when you shoot on film, the film itself would make it look professional.
Yes.
Just the mere existence of film.
Yeah.
And yes, you could have a shitty version of it. You could have poorly shot film.
Mm-hmm.
And that was apparent, sure. But sometimes that was also a bit of a charm, as we talked about with the Texas Chainsaw,
yes.
It's very grainy and at times looks not exposed properly, but it still looks sort of professional because it's film on its own. Whereas video, you really need to know what you're doing to make video not look like crap.
Phantasm. Phantasm is a very low budget movie that's essentially Coscarelli and his family doing everything, shot on film. But because film has that slightly diffused visual aspect of it, just by shooting on film, like you said, you can do a lot of really fun, cool things with it, and you'll get in just the film itself and in the film grain and that slight distance you get. That's one of the things I love about film and things shot on film, is that very slight distance you as an audience member get from what's being shot and what's actually going on. Whereas HD and you know, the modern digital cameras are so precise, and you can do wonderful things with them. Again, granted, there are regular features with money.
But you need to know what you need to know,
or you need to have the money to really
to proceed.
It's weird that what we're talking about is the old days, low budget with film could look better. Today, you need more money with digital to really sell it, unless you're an ace visual stylist. And I don't know that Don Coscarelli has ever been an ace visual stylist necessarily.
Well, also you have, when you start throwing in digital effects, it's really, you're walking a thin line between starting to look like an asylum video.
That's what I noticed on some of them, on some of the scenes.
And I get that as a complaint about John Dies in it, but it's just such a, just a bonkers movie.
It's very fun. Yeah. Now, The Fly, this was weird watching The Fly back to back with that. And granted, watching The Fly on video, but that's a gorgeous film. And that is truly a case where I don't know that the film itself necessarily is phenomenal in terms of storytelling.
Yeah.
I mean, that film kind of sells itself on the very base of the idea, and there's Vincent Price and all that.
It's funny because it doesn't play like a horror movie.
No, it doesn't play
like a sci-fi movie either. It's more or less, really, it's a melodrama.
Yeah.
Is what it is. And that's partly because of the era it was made. That's a very late 50s type of thing.
It's like a Douglas Sirk film with, but instead of marital strife or repressed homosexuality, it's guy has
partly
head
fly.
Turned into a fly's head. Whoops. Yeah,
that happens.
Yeah. But that's a gorgeous
spoiler
film. That really made, whoops, yeah. Sorry. The Fly is not just about a rogue fly.
Yeah.
Although it could be. That was a pleasure to watch. I hadn't seen The Fly since Science Fiction 1997.
Oh, okay.
When it played with the Cronenberg Fly.
Yeah.
And boy, watching it all these years later, that is a fun visual film to watch just because the color is so lush and the production design is minimal, but it's nice.
Yeah.
And that's a testament, I think. That's what, I wonder how things are going to go in the future. Let's just leave it at that. I wonder how things are going to go in the future with films of that ilk that are shot today, like we're talking about with the DV debate, because a film like The Fly in 1958 could be made and not be a blockbuster production, but be competently well made enough, and the level of craftsmanship that your average film crew had at that point.
Well, it was still a higher budget production because The Return of the Fly was black and white.
Yeah, but it's not like, you know, it's not Gone with the Wind.
Oh, yeah.
Like saying by today's standards,
it's not a sweeping epic.
No,
but when they shot it, They took a lot of care.
Yes, they spent money. This isn't High School Confidential. but I think that's a testament to it, is when you look at The Fly, which in some ways was a B picture of its time.
Yeah.
The level of craftsmanship you had on the crew, the production team, everything else like that, can make a film like that look really nice.
Yeah.
And be a very nice visual experience, even if the story is like, oh, okay, it's a fly, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
But that was cool watching that. And then, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, and then also, well, part of it is also that was a new idea back then.
Yes.
And it's such a cliched concept now.
That is part of it, know. Yeah.
It's not even body horror at that point. It's just sort of mutant.
Yeah.
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 It's a different way of doing mutants.
Let's see, that's 58, so, yeah. Hey, if you have a decent amount of that nuclear paranoia or that transformation through mishap of science going on, but it's in such a hardcore sci-fi realm back then. But the third film, probably the delight of the evening for me, was Horror Express, a film that I had never seen before, and I had always wanted to see, and I had always it's fallen into this weird mid zone of I'd love to see that. Should I wait and try to see it on film, or should I wait and try and see it at a marathon, or should I? So finally watching it was a delight.
It's neat because it stars Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, Grand Moff Tarkin, and Count Dooku from Star Wars together again. But it's not a Hammer film.
No.
So it doesn't get the preservation that the Hammer movies tend to get.
Yeah, and it was a Spanish production, right? The main credits in the uncut version are all in Spanish.
So it doesn't get that, and it doesn't get the there's also like the Amicus Productions, the stuff that Peter Cushing was involved in more. It doesn't have that behind it. It's sort of this lost. It's not terribly well preserved. It just came out on Blu-ray.
It's essentially public domain too.
Yeah, it was. I had a friend recommend it to me, and I bookmarked it. I never watched it. And I finally said, I'll put it in one of my marathons. And I'm glad I did, because it does have that Hammer or Amicus feel to it, but it's not one of those. And so that's why it's not sort of preserved in that legacy.
Well, it's a wonderful little film in that it's the limitations it deals with in terms of plot totally add to everything. You're in a train, the titular Horror Express, but it's really small. There's only, what, 4 or 5 cars in the whole thing.
Yeah.
And it's Christopher Lee as this entomologist, or not entomologist, a
sort of like a paleontologist.
Paleontologist discovering this 2-million-year-old half man, half ape in where is it?
In Mongolia.
And taking it back, preserving it for science. Yeah. And that's the hook. And of course, things go wrong. But it goes in directions that are just slightly unexpected, to say the least.
Well, and if you look at the poster and you look at the just sort of like the selling of it, you're just like, oh, it's just a monster movie.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, an escaped creature on the train. But there's actually a lot more to it in terms of story. I'm not going to go into it because there's certain levels of spoilers, but there's a lot more to it than just ape man thaws out and kills people.
And the way they progress that plot is genuinely interesting.
Yeah.
And there were plot points throughout the way and plot developments that when you see them, you think, oh, that's actually kind of cool that they would take it in that way, or that they take someone's motivation in that way for why they do this or why they want to do that.
Yeah.
And all kinds of like little oddball things that pop up in the beginning that sort of coalesce in ways that you would not expect in the end.
Yeah.
And it's fun in that, you know, it's like a locked room mystery.
Yeah.
You're setting it in only 3 or 4 essential sets in the car.
Yeah.
And Telly Savalas pops up 20 minutes from the end as a Cossack to play Telly Savalas.
Pretty much just tell you, he's Kojak in a fancy coat.
Yeah, he's like, hey, I'm a Cossack. What do you want? If someone's gonna die,
he's like
on.
Woken up and he's sleeping with like 2 women, and I mean, it really is kind of this weird stunt casting of the day.
Yeah, I
because it was what 1970, 72, like something
early
like 70s. That,
Well, I told you before the podcast today, you showed the trailer for it at the beginning of the marathon, which has Telly Savalas prominently billed. When I watched Horror Express later that night,
and it says in the opening credits,
Telly
Savalas, as Captain Cassidy.
When he showed up, I had totally forgot he was in the movie.
Yeah,
and it was a great like, oh, this is Telly Savalas. Wow, great.
Because he doesn't show up. It's like 20 minutes until the end,
and that's not really giving a lot away either. But it's just, if you watch it, you'll have to wait for him. But
Yeah, for all you Telly Savalas fans, you just have to be patient.
It was fun. I would definitely watch it again. I think it would be fun to show at a horror marathon someday, like where people pay to come to it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a cool movie. If you haven't seen it, you can find it. Like I said, it recently came out on Blu-ray, and you can find it on YouTube.
It's
and
all over the place. It's been
Amazon.
It has been bootlegged and re-transferred to death over the years. So, and the last two I watched, I waited till the next day because I was getting a little time. I saw The Fly 2. Never seen The Fly 2 before.
What'd you think?
It was, in many ways, much more enjoyable than I thought.
Yeah.
In many ways, it was what I thought it would be.
It's very cheesy late 80s.
Yeah.
For a good chunk of it. But for me, I just like how crazy extreme the creature violence gets. If you thought the creature violence in The Fly by David Cronenberg was nuts, this one just, it just goes.
It is
off the
so rail. Obviously a showcase for Chris Wallace, the effects guy from part one who directs part two, and his crew that do the effects. So clearly a showcase for what they can do. And it has some of the great, how should I put this? Has some of the greatest David Cronenberg special effects to feature in a non-David Cronenberg movie.
I'm getting better.
I don't even want to describe them, but they're good. Very, very visceral and nasty and just great. My one complaint about the effects is once they get to the fly, it's a little disappointing because I get where they were going with it, but I enjoyed his fly in The Fly, in Cronenberg's The Fly, a lot more because it was much more disturbing.
It was the gradual.
Well, and even when he's almost all the way to the transformation, it's just kind of odd. Whereas in this one, they're going for like the classic monster movie version of what that would be, but it's a little bit of a letdown. But there are parts like the first 20 minutes, I think, of this play like gangbusters when he's a kid, when Seth Brundle's child is still in his early stages of childhood. Some really nice little scenes with the young kid who plays him before Eric Stoltz comes into the film.
Yeah.
There are parts, like once they get to the evil security guard, it gets a little wah, wah, wah.
Well, that's why I say it's very 80s, when you really start developing Daphne Zuniga's character.
Yeah. I loved how, is it John Getz who plays Stathisbor?
Yeah.
John Getz shows up for that great, strange cameo halfway through.
He has such a great ending.
I was so hoping, I was really hoping that they would make Stathisbor a main character in part two once he appeared. Like, he would be the guy would help them out.
I like it that that's the guy they got to bridge the two, because Geeta Davis and Jeff Goldblum had both blown up after that movie, they couldn't use them anymore.
Yeah, and it's almost like once you watch the movie, Stathis Bourne's character in part two is relegated to him saying, "I hate the fly. Fuck both of you. Take my car. Goodbye."
Cost me an arm and a leg. Yeah, but that's the best line.
But he's pretty entertaining. So yeah, I like the fly too more than I thought I would.
I saw it in release. I saw it at I may have seen it at
the old Nickelodeon.
I think I saw it at the old Westland Theater. General Cinemas.
The Westland, the eightplex?
Yeah. I think that's where I saw it.
That was my old stomping grounds way back when.
Yeah, back in 1989. I think that's where I saw it. Maybe I saw it at the Continent. I can't remember exactly. But yeah, it was such fun.
If you have Netflix, it's on there. And it's totally worth just setting an hour and 40 minutes aside to check it out. And for the special effects alone.
Yeah. It was that movie, and another one was Hellbound, the sequel to Hellraiser.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Were ones that I remember going with a friend of mine, and we would sneak crazy because it was in the winter that they both came out, I believe, or at least in cold weather, so we had coats.
Yeah.
And we snuck crazy amounts of. We didn't bring like alcohol in. It was like cookies and candy bars and soda. We were like
cookies
filled up.
Boy.
Yeah.
The last film I watched that you showed. And I just saw it last year at the Horror Marathon, and I had seen it once before on video, but Candyman.
Oh, yeah.
Candyman is so fucking good.
Yeah.
Like, I that's one that every time I've seen it, I've grown to appreciate it more. And I'm kind of dumbfounded that more people in general don't regard Candyman as a great horror film of its era, but also as like a really interesting film in and of itself. Take the horror parts out of it, but everything it gets into with urban legends and with the real life Cabrini Green housing project and the sociological aspects of the film, and Virginia Madsen's great, and Tony Todd.
Yeah.
Tony Todd is so awesome in what limited amount he has, and the script is good, and
the music's great,
the Philip Glass score, it's Philip Glass scoring a horror film, and the shocking parts are still, if you forget what goes on, are really shocking, and that's such a great film.
It was something I remember seeing it before it came out, because I was at college at the time, and they had a special preview of it. I actually still have the poster of the preview. Come see it, the free movie from UAO, you know. And I remember in 92 when it came out, I remember seeing it and being kind of like, it was okay. You know, I didn't love it then. It's one of those movies that I think holds up better. Like in 92, it was just another horror film.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, the effects are all practical.
Yeah.
And optical.
Yeah.
There's a couple opticals in there. But it's all practical and optical, so it holds up better than a lot of its contemporary films.
Yes.
And I think part of it is it was so... The name Clive Barker was so associated with Hellraiser
yeah.
that it was hard to not expect something as grotesque as Hellraiser.
Yeah.
And so it was a bit of a letdown because you expect this incredibly iconic type stuff, which it's not directly immediately iconic, but I think it holds up better because I slept through pretty much the entire movie because we played it at, we played Candyman at about 4 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, I need to sleep. I have to sleep through. And I'd seen it before. So I slept and I went ahead and went back and watched it like the next day. And I was like, no, this holds up better. This is a better movie than I remember it being.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that has a lot to do with it. I find it funny that there are some movies that you see and they're just okay when they release and they get better with age, while there's other ones that are fun when you see them and then they don't hold up.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting too watching it this time around because we showed it at the marathon last year.
Yeah.
But we showed it last and I was, you know, a little, I don't remember a ton about it because I was a little tired. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
But I thought it was interesting that even though we didn't intentionally book these two films in connection, that I kept thinking of Suspiria throughout Candyman because it's, even though it's set in a very realistic world, it's another female character who's in the lead who is like essentially undergoing a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
Everything Virginia Madsen goes through defies all logic within that closed little world. And it's just following that to its in many ways natural conclusion and what she goes through. And it's,
and you can you can still watch Candyman and you can choose to believe that it's happening or you can choose to believe that she's schizophrenic.
Yeah. The one thing you know in that movie is that Xander Berkeley is a complete jerk.
And there's no bras.
No, I'm not cheating on you. Yeah. No, of course not.
The gratuitous no bra nipple scene at the end is quite amazing.
You know what was interesting though?
Because when I saw it, when they showed it at the preview, like way back in 92, it got chuckles throughout.
Oh, at the marathon, it totally came out of nowhere.
Because you're just like, why is she, this is so unnecessary.
And
I liked it, but okay.
It's too bad because that scene, and I noticed it again watching it this time, that aspect of the girl not having a bra on and it being so obvious, it almost completely undermines what else is going on in that scene, which is like somewhat moving in terms of that other character's development and that realization they're coming to and everything.
Yeah.
But hey, you know, that's a minor complaint. That's a really great film. And I'm glad this is the thing, coming to your marathon, I really wanted to see a lot of these. So I'm glad I went back, you know, out of respect or tribute or courtesy or something, or I don't know, just because I'm a glutton for punishment. Glad I went back and watched these, but Candyman especially was great. And Horror Express is boffo.
Good fun stuff.
Yeah. Cool. So good job. Well done.
Thank you.
Thumbs up. None of you can see this, but
thank you,
huge thumbs up.
All right. Well, we have to go because we are probably the longest segment we've ever done.
Yeah.
So get your tickets now for the...
Oh, yeah. Where do you get the ticket? Oh, hello. Okay, if you want to get tickets, you should get tickets for the 24-hour horror marathon, Shock Around the Clock, the 666th. The places you can get it, you can go to www.horrormarathon.com. We have a PayPal link there. You can order it via us.
And a couple bucks?
It's like a $2 surcharge, okay.
Is it a $2 surcharge per ticket or per order?
I think it's per ticket. To offset PayPal's charge.
Yeah.
$40 in advance, $45 at the door. You can get it via that PayPal link at horrormarathon.com. We'll send the ticket to you, or we'll keep it and have it for you at the door. Also, you can go to the Laughing Ogre Comics, 4258 North High Street, right next door to the old Dear Departed Drexel North. And of course, please, 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 please go to the Drexel Theater in Bexley. They also have tickets, and we would love for you guys to really patronize them, even outside of the marathons, because I can't emphasize enough, they have been so good to us with especially the last year and a half of marathons. They have been nothing but supportive, and they are, you know, fantastic people there. And you know, we always want to draw or divert any business their way outside of the marathons as much as we can. So you can also pick up your ticket there in person with one of their courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent Boy Scout employees.
Wow.
I was an Eagle Scout, I still have that back in the old filing cabinet. So yeah, tickets on sale now. Check them out, please, by all means.
Awesome. Well, we've got to go. We will talk to you guys next time.
Thanks, Kevin.